Hi, everybody. It's Jim Beekdye. The podcast is Be You. The world will adjust. And as part of the summer series, I've been asking people that I know and friends to epitomize the Be You, the world will adjust. And not many more than my friend Dean Hopkins, who I guess by now, Dean, we've probably known each other almost 15, 20 years, which is which is hard to believe because, you know, I mean, it's just, I was thinking that today that, Christ, I've known him for a long time. But then again, I've been around on this earth for a long time. Welcome to the show. Dean is the COO of Oxford Properties, and he's had a very, very interesting career. And in the vein of my summer series, which is pivot and adapt, Dean was pivoting and adapting long before pivoting and adapting was a thing. So welcome, Dean. Maybe you can start us out by talking about how you talked your way into McKinsey, the management consulting field, because it didn't fit their mold.
No, thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me. I'm happy my story can potentially help others see something in themselves that I certainly have only recently come to see in myself. I mean, I started out very simply. I was a lowly engineer at University of Waterloo, graduating in the early 90s when it was a terrible time to graduate. And I saw this great company, McKinsey and Company. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll throw my hat in the ring and see if I can get in. And what was really interesting is they'd never hired anybody other than a business student before. So I was sort of this engineer that was very out of the mold, but I managed to kind of convince them that I could hold my own with the business guys and did all of the right things on all of the case studies. Although one case study that they give you in the interview, I had no idea what the words were that they were talking about. So I had them actually have to simplify because they were using all sorts of terms from income statements and balance sheets, which engineers don't know how to read. Somehow I managed to get them to believe in me. And I joined McKinsey and had an unbelievable 3 years and really kind of took to it like a fish to water because they realized that actually the quantitative skills and problem-solving skills of engineers were a really good fit for McKinsey. And subsequently, they went on to hire a bunch of engineers thereafter. So it was a great way to start my career, despite having not a lot of business experience going in. I learned a ton and had a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's great. And it's great. You know, very few organizations have that ability to recognize sort of the odd man out and then realize, holy shit, he's not the odd man out. We should have more. we should have more of that. You know, it's an interesting juxtapose because, you know, most organizations are sort of like, well, this is what we're like. You either fit in or you don't fit in. But a McKinsey and, you know, very few others probably can sort of pivot and adapt and say, holy shit, you know, we've got too many of the old world here and we've got to be part of the new world.
You know, the one thing that I learned, because I started being on the recruiting side after I joined McKinsey, and I realized the one thing they're looking for isn't even as much curriculum based, but it's this thing that they've referred to called an insecure overachiever, which is a really interesting way to think about it, which is, and you can spot them a mile away because they're the people that have great marks and are on all the top teams and everything, but you meet them and they're still unsure of kind of who they are and unsure that they're not boastful. They don't brag. They're sort of still wondering whether they're good enough to make it in. And McKinsey's got some incredible ways to spot these insecure overachievers and then turn them in and use that energy that they have and turn them into amazing people.
Yeah, last week's podcast was about the imposter syndrome, and that's those kinds of people. Insecure overachievers always have an imposter syndrome, right? It drives everything. So you leave McKinsey, which, you know, many people do, unless you become a lifer like our dear friend Ron Farmer, and you like working with people that aren't as smart as you on the outside. And Ron's going to kill me for saying that, but that's fine. but it's true. And then you and Vern, you know, who also you've met at McKinsey, you know, start this company, Cyberplex.
Yeah, it was, I think we talked a little bit about this off camera, which was, it wasn't so my original idea to start Cyberplex. I was at McKinsey going along, getting ready to go to Harvard, which is generally a pattern that follows after McKinsey. And I got rejected from Harvard. Despite kind of having all the accolades and all the right things. And it was like a real low point in my life. realizing, oh shit, I can't do the thing that I really wanted to do. What am I going to do with my life? And a friend of mine at the time, also a friend of Vernon and Ron's of mine, a guy named Merdad Baghai, who's gone on to do amazing things, gave me this book called The Alchemist. And The Alchemist is sort of a very simple tale about a shepherd that goes and follows his dream. Anyway, it's a great book. It's become a life kind of long story for me. And it really helped me pick me up, dust myself off, and realize this wasn't the end of the road. And call it duck and jive and pivot and however you like. This was a good chance to say, this is the universe telling me something. I've got to get out ahead of this. And I then bucked up and spent the next year at McKinsey really honing my skills, applied to Harvard again, didn't get in again. I said, okay, something's not right here. I got to go do something else, which turned out to be, you know, leaving and starting this company in 1994 before the internet was even really a thing, helping people market on the internet, which was radical, crazy, out of the box idea. In fact, the McKinsey guy said, "What, you're leaving McKinsey to go do what?" And I said, I just have this kind of drive, this passion to go and do this. Clearly the school thing isn't working out, so I'll go and do this entrepreneurial thing. The rest is really history. We had an unbelievable run. 5 years later, we grew the company from zero to 50 million in revenue and $1 billion market cap.
Way ahead of its time, right?
Oh yeah. In 1994, there was about less than 100 websites in the whole world when I started the company.
Everybody was still doing dial-up.
They were still doing dial-up. They're still doing CompuServe and America Online. In fact, it took me 18 months to get my very first customer, and I had to stick it out. I ran out of money a couple times. Vernon had to bail me out. I mean, I really didn't know what I was doing. I'd never had a paper route. I'd never had any kind of entrepreneurship in me. My parents were both teachers. So I had to surround myself with great people who kept propping me up and saying, you can do this. I know it's there. And I listened to them and I stuck it out. And luckily I did, because about 18 months and one day in, we suddenly turned a corner and everything just lit up. And it was an unbelievable experience growing a company to 500 people from nothing. It was tremendously rewarding.
And then you had the heartache of having to take the company the other way. Talk about that, because you know everybody talks about the success stories of organizations, and all of a sudden, you know, eulogize the people that have been so successful. Oh, he was brilliant. Oh, he was this. But very few entrepreneurs, you know, have a straight line shot. They've got a long list of things that didn't work. And as I said before, you know, too early, too late, same graveyard, right? But tell my listeners about it, because it's important.
So we were on fire. It was sort of 99 2000. Our stock was trading at an all-time high. It was, you know, literally nothing could go wrong. But here I was sitting in our office knowing that something was coming, because I was looking at our data about our contracts, our sales volumes, and they were starting to fall off a cliff. And I realized this thing is about to end. And sure enough, the dot-com bubble bursts in around 2000 2001. The confidence in all things kind of online goes out. A bunch of people are on the street. And I realized that our business was in real challenge, because that's what we did. We helped people build things for the internet. So I realized we were going to have to shrink. Like, our contract volume went to, you know, a tenth of what we had contracted. And in the next 7 quarters, we went from 50 million in revenue to 5 million in revenue. We went from 500 people to 50 people. And so I had to get rid of 450 people in 7 quarters and save the business, which was public. Went from $30 a share to 30 cents a share in that period of time. You know, imagine standing in front of shareholders and standing in front of employees and trying to guide people through that at the tender age of what I was, 32 or 33 at the time.
Yeah, you're a baby.
Really challenging times. We were really proud of how we handled it, though. We made sure everybody, as many people as we could, got jobs, pulled a lot of favors in to re-employ our great people. We paid everybody, all you know, worked out with landlords. Nobody was left in the lurch, no lawsuits. And at that bottom quarter, 7 quarters later, after a 90% drop in revenue, we were profitable. So we really had a great team that pulled together really well. And I probably learned more in that 7 quarters than I've learned collectively in the rest of my career over 27 years. It was just an incredibly dense period of time of learning. So I've talked openly about it to as many people as I can to sort of tell the tale, because entrepreneurs, like you said, Jim, you learn not through necessarily all the decisions you make when the times are good. You learn through the decisions you make when the times are tough. And that's what you know, I take forward with me is just, we survived that. By the way, Cyberplex is, it's called something else now. It's called EQ Works, but it's still around 26 years later. And it is the story of resilience. You know, it's probably on its fourth or fifth pivot. It's doing really well economically. And fortunately, I left in 2005, which is even a greater story from my point of view. It survived and pivoted multiple times after I left, which meant I put some good DNA in there when we created it, which I'm really proud of.
You mentioned to me before about when you were down in the depths of despair doing this thing and going from 500 people to 50 people. Your fortunate great life partner had some words of encouragement for you. Maybe you could share those with us.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I met Cheryl in the early days, well, 1992, before I even started Cyberplex. So I was still at McKinsey. And, you know, we got married in 96 and had three kids while the company was exploding, you know, 98, 99, and 2001. So, you know, tripling the business every year, tripling the family at the same time, you know, it was crazy years. But she always said to me, listen, everybody trusts you. They know you're going to do the right thing. And you've always looked up and ahead. Don't let this get you down. You'll figure it out. You've got the right people around you. Everybody's got your back. Let's just make sure that we stay the course here. And you've got a great life. Don't let it get you down. And, you know, I absolutely live those words today. We're still having an unbelievable family and relationship. And I wouldn't have been able to survive had I not known that she had my back. She said, I got the kids. I got the family. I got this under control. You focus on that and make sure your people are taken care of. And we did. And it was an incredibly great partnership and still is. And so to me, I was very, very fortunate to be surrounded by unbelievable people, including my wife. And I would never have been able to handle it without the advisors and the, you know, the partners I had in the journey.
And people don't quite appreciate, you know, having been through a few things myself, as you're aware, people don't appreciate that stress comes not only when things aren't going well, but stress also comes when things are going extremely well and they're out of control well and that type of stuff. And people need someone in their lives to help provide balance and support. Both ways, you know, probably as that company was growing and then probably, you know, even more so on the other side of the coin. So from here, you've unencumbered yourself. You're still a young guy. I think you told me you met someone from, you were doing some consulting work for Thompson and that started your next leg of your life.
Yeah. And I, you know, I reflect on it now as the world has been kind to me. I put my hand up to say, okay, it's time for me to go. At Cyberplex around 2005, business was in good shape. The CFO at the time had come to me and said, you know, I'd like to be the CEO of something someday. I said, hey, great. Why don't you be the CEO of Cyberplex? You're the key. I'm ready to roll. And at the time, I was finishing out a few consulting assignments for the company. And one of them was with a person who's become a really great friend of mine, Rick King. Back then, he was the CIO and CTO of a very large group, the legal division. And he and I were working on some projects together, and I told him in Switzerland, hey, listen, I'm about to, you know, become a free agent because I'm going to leave Cyberplex and look for my next gig. And he said, well, you can't do that. You got to come and help me. You know, I got lots to do. I need your advice. I need your counsel. I need your partnership. Can you come and help me out? And I said, okay, well, on an interim basis, on a temporary basis, I will come and give you a couple days a week while I kind of dust myself off and figure out what I want to do next. And then 12 years later, we were still teamed up, partnered up, and had done some unbelievable things over those 12 years. And that is yet another chapter of my story, which I could never have written. You know, looking back on it, I wouldn't have chosen it, but it was an absolutely something I wouldn't trade because of all the things I learned, all the people I, and relationships I built, and some of the amazing work that we've done.
You know, it's interesting. And, you know, as I said early in the cast, we've known each other for a while. You helped me great with an online venture, Nakuda online recruiting system that I was trying to build again way too early. And later on, you know, I'd realized that there was lots of different ways that it could morph. But, you know, one of the interesting things that I've always found in hanging around with you and time that we spent together, you always bookend your adventures with, you know, I met this really great person. I really liked him. We clicked. You know, for me, that means we fit. And the work seemed interesting and challenging. So I said, sure, let's give it a go. With no sort of start, finish, end date, no sort of extra thought about, oh, is this good for my career, you know, or this, or should I be doing this? Just like looking for good people and looking for good opportunities. And if I can kind of get those two things, then that's a pretty good start.
Yeah, that's been my whole arc of my career is people loyalty. McKinsey was an unbelievable treasure trove of people. I built my own team at Cyberplex, and we were, you know, I handpicked every single one of those people, and it was unbelievable. Then I started working with Rick, and I just knew there was a chemistry there. And the other people that I met around him were equally incredible, global. It was a much more global team. So I met people all over the world, and that was a new thing for me. And I just felt an immense amount of loyalty to these people and wanting to help and wanting to get, you know, the team wanted to win together. And to me, that was really exciting. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the challenge, the immensity of the challenge. And I felt, to me, if I got the immensity of a challenge, a really steep challenge that I've got to learn a lot in, an amazing group of people, that's the kind of the ingredients that make for me to want to do something. And every single transition I made in my life has all been about those two things. Huge opportunity to learn, an immense challenge, plus an unbelievable team of people that I feel like they've got my back and that we will do amazing things together. The money was never part of it. You know, the prestige was never part of it. Title, structure, where I was in the organization, none of those things factored into it at all. It was just people and challenge. Those were the two things.
It's hard to unencumber people of all that bullshit, right? And get people to the point where you say, just do a good job, you know, be successful, help more people than help you. You know, just the basic stuff. And you've really lived your life with that sort of code of honor. It's impressive. And what's impressive is you maintain that level of enthusiasm in every single thing that you've ever done. And even whether it was doing that project for me, it was like as if, you know, you own the entire company and you're working 24 hours a day. And I think because you live your life by that code of ethics, it enables you to be that enthusiastic and connected and really want to help and make things better. And I think that far too many people in this day and age are, you know, they're four steps down the road. You know, what does this mean? Is this a good step? Is it not a good step? You know, all that shit, right? You're just like.
Yeah, no. I was fortunate. Like, I think my grandmother lived till she was 99, and she lived through wars and moving from one continent to another and losing her husband and, you know, just amazing set of things you would think would get somebody down. Never, ever did. She was absolutely upbeat. She taught me to be optimistic and see the good in things and pay it forward. And so to me, that was hugely, you know, formational for me. My dad was always the one that said to me, all you have is your integrity. Build it up. If you have two choices, pick the high road at all times. And so to me, the combination of those two things. And then my YPO group, I don't know whether we've talked about it, but I've been in a Young President's Organization sort of group of folks since 1999 that have been incredibly formative, almost like my personal board of directors. And we practice this code of ethics called be a net giver, which is, you know, there's no real math behind it, but it's like, how can we force multiply? How can we give more than we take out of the system? And so to me, those are the ingredients that make my life, that's how I live my life. It's the code.
Full and rich.
Yeah, absolutely.
So a couple of other things you take on, startup businesses, but then you get this incredible opportunity when John Ruffalo is leaving Omers and they want you to come in and be the chief operating officer of Oxford Properties. And I know your life story. Now everybody knows your life story. And there's not a piece of the word real estate in any of it. So how does that happen?
So John put me in touch with Michael Turner, who was just made the president of Oxford. And Michael and John had a great relationship. And he said, you know, you got to meet this guy, Dean, because I've known John for years and years. And Michael and I got along like a house on fire. Again, it was one of these moments of click, right? So, you know, he and I just started talking a lot about the art of the possible and how technology could shape industries and possibly how it could shape real estate. And we just had some really, really thoughtful discussions. And that kind of stuck with Michael. So then when he was constructing a role to help really imagine the future of Oxford, what does a real estate company look like in 2025 and 2030? And who's going to architect that? How are they going to work on the management team? He kind of came back and knocked on my door and said, would you consider this? Because it sounds a lot like, you know, what you did at Thomson Reuters, but brought into the real estate world. And I said, real estate? Like, that seems crazy. I don't know anything about real estate. And he started constructing similar conditions to what I reflect back on was, you know, what Rick did at Thomson Reuters. He said, well, listen, Real estate's a $200 trillion a year industry. We're one of the leaders globally. It's about to be shaped by technology. Wouldn't you like a front row seat? Wouldn't this make a lot of sense for you to come in and bring all your 27 years of experience to a new industry, new group of people, and you get to decide how it's going to unfold? And I'm like, oh, that sounds pretty interesting. Let me meet the people. So you had the immensity of the challenge. I really like Michael, but I needed to get to know the rest of them. Unfortunately, I'd worked with Ali Wolf a little bit, who's the CFO. I got to meet the rest of the team, and I just fell in love with the team. And I said, you know, okay, my two tick boxes are here, right? But then an additional piece ended up in the kind of net giving attitude, which is Oxford is part of OMERS, and OMERS pays pensions. So we pay 500,000 pensions a year through OMERS. We're the real estate arm of OMERS. So we have a big contribution towards that. And I felt it was nice to be part of an organization whose mantra isn't about maximizing wealth, right? It's actually about paying pensions. And it felt like a good place to be is to help the world be a better place at the same time as the immensity of the challenge and working with a great team. So those ingredients came together and I said, all right, if they believe in me, I believe in them. Let's go.
So now how long have you been in the role again?
Just a little over a year now.
A little over a year. Has everything materialized, not from your perspective, but you know, when you bring someone like you in, the risk of organ failure into the organization is very, very high. And it's not because of the person you bring in, is because every organization thinks they want to change, right? Every single organization, whether you're at McKinsey, you know, advising or at, everybody believes they want to change because they understand they need to change, but not every organization is open to what change means for them, what they have to bring to the table in order to maximize and utilize the skill sets that you bring to the table. Because if they bring someone like you and it's an interesting idea. No, you don't really understand real estate, you know, or I don't think we're quite ready for that. You know, then basically, you know, as I say in my book, you're a 10,000 yard passing quarterback in a team that only runs the ball. You know, it doesn't matter, right? So you've had a year to reflect back on it. How's that looked?
Well, it took about 6 months for Michael and I to have a good conversation to get me into the role. I did a lot of due diligence on kind of the state of play, where they were in sort of preparing the field, so to speak, to embark upon this ambitious route that they wanted to go on. And Michael had spent the better part of 18 months by the time I joined advocating for his vision of kind of Oxford in the future. And so when I joined, it made sense because I was like the puzzle piece dropping in to be able to help get the organization to that next place. And so, you know, that came through loud and clear when I did my interviews, when I talked to people, when I really got behind the story. And I saw the change hunger in people. They wanted to change. They knew that where they were wasn't where they wanted to be. There was a tremendous drive and culture in the organization. And everybody was like, we're up for it. Let's go. How do we help? And in the intervening year, that's exactly what I've experienced. I've experienced a lot of an appetite for working together collectively to drive this change. And what I've really loved about it is we've driven it from inside, right? We've collectively worked together to fashion the vision for what we want it to be. And that's really driving the change because there's this huge amount of appetite. We've been able to mobilize the expertise in the room, in the building, in the organization to make the change happen. And I'm more or less just sort of the Sherpa, a little bit of the architect of the change, but I'm really letting the genius flow up from inside the organization.
It's amazing. You know, I often say, and people have heard me say on my podcast, knowledge lies in the body of the institution. And yet very few people ever ask the people running the businesses what's wrong and what doesn't work. And it is stunning to me. And I see it day in, day out. And I always encourage, you know, CEOs and business leaders that I coach to go down a couple of levels, bring together young people from a few levels down and ask them what they should do. And I remember having a conversation with one of the CEOs of the bank about, it was right around the time ING had just, the online banking giant had just formed. So I guess it would have been in the early 2000s. And we were talking and I said, my suggestion for this year, because I used to come visit these people at the beginning of the year, was to get about 25 or 30 young people, warehouse them in a business completely separate from the bank, and give them a list of all the businesses that the bank is in, and ask them to find out who's disintermediated them or how they could come up with ideas on how to disintermediate themselves. You know, of course, he chuckled and he said, we're doing pretty well. You know, really, you know, we're not worried about, you know, ING and, you know, no, they only went off to be sold for $3 billion and we're not worried about these things. But it's so tried and true that the people actually doing the business know what's wrong.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we two things that made my life a ton easier is Michael Turner, the president, had spent the better part of the last 18 months, call it creating the case for change, right? Out on the podium, talking to everybody, saying, listen, we're going to be, you know, we already are, but we're going to continue to be the best real estate company in the world. And we're going to put some distance on our competitors. And we're, you know, we have this view called Oxford 4.0, which is about, you know, it's a more of about a mentality. It's about a way of thinking, which is always challenging ourselves to be better and looking for better and newer and faster and better ways to do things. And so by the time I got there, there's already this momentum to say, great, how do we do this, right? How, you know, and so I basically just captured and harnessed and channeled all that energy into a series of things that were low-hanging fruit that the business had already decided that they wanted to do, but didn't necessarily know how to go from aspiration to getting it done. And we coined this term. Actually, I didn't coin it. It was my colleague, Adam Fraser, who runs our leasing business in the US, that coined it, called For Us, By Us, FUBU. And it's basically mobilizing the internal energy, thought leadership, capabilities, insight from the organization to sort of craft the solution that will work best for us, and partnering that up with thought leadership and insight and art of the possible from kind of the technology side to creating a kind of a vision of the future that we truly own. It isn't handed to us by a consultant. It isn't, you know, we're not looking and ripping somebody off from the outside. We're actually truly creating this ourselves. And that makes the change process of getting people to go from the way they're comfortable doing things today to a new way of doing things so much easier, because it's their doing. And that's the whole way that we do things at Oxford now: for us, by us, engineering our future, manifesting our own destiny. And I'm just really, call it, the architect of that. And my teams are all about facilitating and supporting that energy in that direction.
That's awesome. That's great. So one last question that I sort of, if we think about the world in stages of Internet 1.0, Internet 2.0, sort of taking us through the 2000s, I recently read an article on how the pandemic has accelerated the move to online by 10 years in 6 weeks. My view is, you know, when people keep saying, when we go back to normal, and I'm like, there is no going back, Dorothy. You know, the cart's left the barn, the horse has left the barn, and it's this thing's going to look completely different going forward. But I'm all, you know, as I'm always interested in your thoughts, because I harass you all the time about them. When you see through your eyes, because you have this ability to see quite greatly and widely and with large bandwidth, what do you see sort of globally, the big opportunities coming ahead of us?
Well, there's a few that I keep my eyes on. You know, there was already a series of these things underway. They were kind of on a bit of a slow boat that where we are has poured gasoline on, so to speak, right? So the way in which we think about work was slowly evolving into a different framing of work. Even if you think about how many years it's taken for people to accept entrepreneurship and side hustles, which we talked about earlier in the conversation, and gig economy work and people being flexible in their work path and now being able to work from anywhere. So I think that's not for every job. That's we tend to talk about that, I think, too widely, because that's all about knowledge workers, and that's only a small percentage of our population. But of workers who are headed down the knowledge worker pathway, it means that we have to think very differently about the way in which we work together and the use of our space in terms of how we do that. And what we're finding is that I think people let the pendulum swing too far. It's like, oh, people are going to work from home forever. Not going to happen. What we realized is the social capital that's built up, the relationships, the creativity that's unlocked when people are physically together in a room, being through a screen is no substitute for that. So what we're likely to see is that people are going to rethink the way they use their office space to create venues, to unlock that social capital, to build relationships, to allow for creativity to occur. And people are going to want to go to those places instead of being compelled to go. So this notion of work where you're most effective. If you're most effective at home doing heads down analysis, stay at home and do that. If you're going to be brainstorming, doing creative work, and because you need to think through something with your colleagues, there'll be a venue for that. And the folks that work this out, reconfigure and tie technology deeply into those experiences so that you can mobilize what is the second theme, are going to be big winners. The second theme is really the harnessing or the unleashing of underrepresented communities into these great jobs, right? So we've talked a lot about, especially in tech and finance, and the underrepresentation of women in these groups and the underrepresentation of minorities in these groups are talent pools that people are not tapping. And it's because some of them are hard to get to, they're in the wrong places, they haven't traditionally been sought after. Technology is a great leveler, and it's going to allow us to open up those talent pools and really take advantage of them in new and creative ways that we wouldn't have had to, we wouldn't have been able to in the past. And I think that's exciting because all of this is about a war for talent, right? The space is about a war for talent, the way your culture works, your access to unbelievable people that you wouldn't have typically sought out. And I think this COVID experience has allowed us to say, I don't need to always recruit in New York and Toronto and Boston. You know, if a great person exists in Latvia and they're going to be the best person to add to my team, I can do that now. I can actually open my aperture up about where those people are and find the absolute best person for the role and be able to bridge the gap that we had before. So I think that's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, I think that, as I've made comment here before and I've said to people, when you think about call centers, how fast people adapted to moving people out of a call center into their homes. But when you reflect back on it, you think, how stupid was it? Because most call center people live outside the city, so they commute for an hour to come into a building to sit in a cubicle and then leave and go back for another hour. Like, I mean, in retrospect, what were people thinking? Yet now the ability to hire people on a part-time basis, basically you have a slot every week of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to fill, and you're agnostic to what part of the world fills it.
Correct. That whole called liquidity of talent, the enabling of that through tech, globalizing our perspective, we haven't seen the end of that yet. It's also interesting that there's a whole set of domains that technology hasn't reached yet. Like, people talk about, you know, us being very tech forward, but I know just looking under the covers of buildings, for say, right, infrastructure. Tech-enabled infrastructure is in its infancy, right? The ability for a building to adapt to your needs, to say, oh, Jim's coming in, I'm going to send the elevator. So the elevator's waiting for him. You know, your area that you're going to go to, lights come up, temperature's at the exact right spot that you want it, and, you know, the right lunch is ordered for you, and all your colleagues kind of are there when you get there because they've all been anticipated by the building itself. That's all not Star Trek. It's just we're not doing that. The ability for the building to heal itself, to detect its own issues, dispatch people to fix them, interaction with the fire department, the city, the transit authorities to guide people to come when they should be coming and shouldn't be coming. The ability for us to put brains in infrastructure and to allow those brains to deliver better experiences for us as consumers, we haven't even seen anything on that front yet. And yet that's where we're headed. Now that brings cybersecurity and a whole bunch of other things, privacy and stuff into it. But we will see dramatic changes in the way in which our physical infrastructure reacts to us that will help us consume it more effectively and more enjoyably. I think that's really exciting.
So the last thing for people that are listening, Dean, and everybody says, oh yeah, well, you know, he's a biochemical engineer or systems engineer, and you know, he's got all this experience, and you know, it's easy for people like that. Or, you know, Jim, you came from the financial services world, and you know, there's a tendency of people say, oh, but this. But your wife started a company, and I don't know where it is.
Still going, still kicking. Yeah,
that's good. But I think what's really important is that Cheryl came up with this idea listening to two guys at spin class.
Yeah, I was, it's a very good story. And it, you know, so here's a kind of a late 40s woman who's sort of now a professional sommelier, and she's looking for her next adventure, and accidentally the universe kind of shows her an opportunity. And she's listening to two guys working out and hearing that they, you know, when they fish, they would like to fish with Alka-Seltzer because it helps attract the fish. They're wondering why there's no product like that on the market. So she had this, again, I mentioned the moment of epiphany. She had an epiphany moment as an entrepreneur and said, I wonder if a bath bomb would work in this setting. And so she, long story short, invented a company called Bait Cloud, which basically takes bath bomb technology, inserts things that fish are interested in, and has now created a company that is, that went viral on the internet. She did a video, small little video that went to 10 million users in 72 hours, very quickly got into Walmart and Bass Pro and kind of all the category retailers all around North America. And here's a woman with, you know, just an idea and a passion to do it and put the work in. And it was a lot of work, and has now got this great little successful company that is chugging along. And it shows you anybody from anywhere, from any walk of life, if you're willing to put the work in and if you have that moment of inspiration, you too can get it done.
That's great. I love that story. I tell that story a million times, and especially her R&D in the bathtub of your house.
Yeah, it stunk up the house. It was horrible. But I was willing to support her dream. So,
But the thing is those ideas, are that moment that she had in that gym with those people, everybody has those moments. People walk by them all the time and don't grab them and aren't attuned to them, aren't listening to them. Or the worst part for me is the, that'll never work. Well, that's a stupid idea, right? Nobody knows what a stupid idea is. Nobody knows what'll never work. And the marketplace of technology companies is a testament to that. You think about the journey of Amazon from where it first originated to where it currently is the behemoth that it is today. Anyways, Dean, you know I love you like a second brother. I always love talking and listening to you. I regret the fact that I never had the opportunity to work on a side-by-side basis, but I want to thank you very, very much. Wish you and your family a happy Labor Day weekend, and I'll see you soon, and we'll get you out on the links up at Goodwood, maybe with Ron and Vern, and we'll reunite the team.
Very good. Yeah, that was a great trip we had, and I still remember that game of golf we had where we were, three behind with three to go. Three behind with four to go. We demoralized them and won.
We did. All right, Dean, thanks. Best of luck to you. Podcast is BU. The world will adjust.